Everyone, welcome to this event. My name is Louisa Morse. I'm the Division Chair of STR. Thank you very much for being here at this symposium on corporate strategy. I would really heartfully like to thank Philip Meyer-Doyle for organizing and putting together this session. And also thank you very much to the presenters and discussants for contributing to this session. At STR, we run several online events as a service to the entire strategic management community. And if you haven't already done so, I invite you to check out our YouTube channel and find some of the online events there. You can also find them as podcasts on Spotify. So you can go back and listen to this event later on, for example. And you can find information about our upcoming events on the STR website. I look very much forward to our discussion today, and I will now hand over to Philip to introduce the symposium and the speakers and discussants for the event today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Luis, and welcome, everybody. My name is Philip Meyer-Doyle. I'm an associate professor of strategy at INSEAD and as member of the executive committee of the STR division. It's my great pleasure to organize this year's virtual symposium on corporate strategy research. And we've got a fantastic lineup today. So we've got four speakers who are going to present their latest research on corporate strategy topics, and two distinguished discussants who will provide their comments on these four papers. And so each speaker will have roughly about 12 minutes to share their thoughts with us. So today we've got Lisa Tang, who is an assistant professor of strategy and policy at NUS Business School in Singapore. We've got Colleen Cunningham, an assistant professor of entrepreneurship and strategy at the Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah. And both of their papers will be discussed by Connie Helford, the J. Brian Quinn professor in technology and strategy at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. And then after that, we have Marc Desjardins, who is an associate professor of business administration at Tuck as well, and Catherine Magelson, assistant professor of strategy and entrepreneurship at LBS. And both of their papers will be discussed by Emily Feldman, who's the Michael Tarnopol professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. If you have got any questions and comments on the papers that will be presented, feel free to post them in the chat. And if we've got time at the end, there'll also be the opportunity for you to, of course, raise these and share them with the authors as well. So without further ado, let me start and hand over to Lisa, who will be our first presenter.
Okay, just give me a second to share my screen. Hey, y'all see this? Okay, great. All right, hello everyone. First, thank you so much, Philip, for organizing this wonderful symposium on corporate strategy. Today, I'm really excited to present this joint work with Daniel Albert from Drexel and John Eklund from USC. And instead of a traditional hypothesis testing paper, today we would actually like to introduce a new data set on organizational structure, which we believe will be of interest to many of corporate strategy scholars today. So the starting point, I think everyone would agree that org structure is an important topic in strategy, especially to many of the questions related to corporate strategy. However, data access to high quality, in-depth measures of firms' org structure has often been challenging. Many of the existing works have either taken a conceptual approach or relied on industry-specific data or focused on specific time periods, which can be limiting in terms of generalizability across context. And also there's been a lack of a consistent nomenclature and measures for various org structure concepts. So in our paper, we hope to address these challenges and move the current conversations forward by introducing a novel, meticulously hand-collected data set on the org structure of S&P 500 firms in the last three decades, which we plan to make available to all researchers. So historically, scholars have taken nearly three approaches to measure firms' org structure. They have either taken taking a survey approach to measure structure by surveying managers' perceptions, or use proxies such as pattern assignments or the distribution of employees, or they have done through an archival approach by leveraging publicly available data. And this last approach is also the approach that we take in our work. Specifically, we infer firm structures based on the composition of their executive team, which is something that we can collect for a large number of publicly listed firms across industries over a long period of time. We developed our data in four stages. First, we focused our data collection efforts on the S&P 500 firms, which account for about 80% of the total market cap of the US equity market. And then we developed a template and trained a team of RAs to collect data on all executives listed in the firm's 10-Ks, annual reports, and proxy statements, including key information regarding their name and complete job title. And we actually found that oftentimes executive information in the 10-K is incomplete, so we made sure to check and collect additional information as disclosed in annual reports. Once the raw data is collected, we then undertook an iterative labeling process. We first tried to use established ways of categorizing job titles, such as using RAs or dictionary rules. But later on, we decided that we will leverage generative AI to complete our labeling process, which I will explain more in the next slide. So after we have labeled all job titles using ChatGPT, we then manually checked again all the data to ensure accuracy. So in total, in our data, we have about 110,000 executive firm year observations covering about 10,000 firm years, which we have on average 11 executives per firm year and about 19 years of data per firm. So now let me say a little bit more about our labeling process. So we constructed measures of org structure in terms of managerial roles and ranks based on the existing literature, and also we carefully reviewed our raw data. So specifically, we came up with six broad managerial roles to classify all job titles, and those roles also align with the value chain responsibilities of the firm. We also came up with 12 managerial rank categories, which capture all ranks as disclosed by the S&P 500 firms themselves in our sample period. And this rank data would actually allow researchers to create hierarchy measures based on internal firm data and thus avoid problems of arbitrarily imposing the same rank distribution across firms with the same title, for example, vice president, may actually refer to different ranks depending on the firm. So to classify all 110,000 firm job titles into these 18 categories, it's very important to have a good understanding of the context of the specific job title. And specifically for the roles relating to business units, and also in cases when the executive are holding multiple roles. So after we explored both dictionary-based and RA-based labeling approaches, we decided to take advantage of the recent breakthroughs in large language models, specifically pre-trained models that are extremely apt at understanding human language and context. So in our AI labeling stage, we further fine-tuned a pre-trained model from OpenAI. So fine-tuning is very different from the simply prompting. Right? Fine-tuning is a process that changes the original model's behavior to better align with a particular task. So in our case, the task is a classification and labeling of job titles. So to develop a fine-tuned model, we first created a training set that consists of 4,000 random observations from our sample and 130 synthetic edge cases. And then we split the sample 70-30 in terms of training and validation. We also made sure to double check the training set to ensure that all the appropriate labels are assigned. So for example, in this example, you see here, Chief Financial Officer and Vice President of Consumer Markets, the correct role labels should include CXO, Support Function, and Business Unit. And then the rank label should be VP, should also be picked up. And you can see here, you know, for example, for the business unit roles, it's very easy for us to assign it. However, this is something that would be difficult to define a dictionary or use keyword search to pick up because the name of business units would vary depending on the firm. But this rule is something that we can actually train and then fine-tune language models on. So we then trained our model three times using GPT 3.5 Turbo in OpenAI. And this is the highest available model in OpenAI for fine-tuning purposes. And then we evaluated the final model with another 1,000 random observations from our data set. And we found a 97% accuracy, which is actually higher than our own human coding. We then applied this frozen final model to our entire sample. So in terms of high-level observations that we find from our data, that over the last 30 years, executive teams have become much smaller, as you can see in the blue line here. And at the same time, we actually saw a proliferation of chief officer roles, which witnessed about a 3%, three-time increase from 13% to 42% of the executive team. If we looked at the proportion of different types of roles consistent with the work of Guadalupe and co-authors, we observe a small increase in the proportion of primary and support function roles, where the increase in support function roles is often driven by the emergence of specialized roles in certain areas such as strategy or corporate development. We also saw a drop in the proportion of business unit roles as firms increasingly centralize their operations with fewer business units. In terms of hierarchy, we saw a slight decline on average, but there are actually a lot of variations across industries, as you can see from this graph. So for example, you can see that the utilities firm actually witnessed a steady increase in hierarchy, while financial institutions firm have become less hierarchical, especially after the financial crisis. Our data also provides in-depth within firm data, which would allow scholars to study organizational strategic change over time. So for example, many of you may be familiar with Microsoft's famous reorganization in 2013 from previously a decentralized BU-focused organization towards a functional structure, similar to what Facebook and Apple have done for years. And as you can see from this chart, our data nicely reflects this change as measured in terms of the proportion of BU roles versus the proportion of functional roles over time. As we plan to make this data set publicly available, we also plan to provide firm identifiers such as QSIP and GVTs, which researchers can then easily merge with other established data sources such as CompuSet, SDC, and CRISP. We also compared our data against ExecuComp, which also provides data on executives of public firms. However, ExecuComp typically only report the top five highest paid executives and not the entire team as reported in annual reports and 10-Ks. And we found that nearly 95% of the firm years, our data actually is better or is at the same level as the coverage as ExecuComp. So in terms of relevance for this audience, we believe that there are many exciting research opportunities related to corporate strategy that scholars can explore using our data set. So for example, future research can leverage our data to examine changes in org structure and resource redeployment among business units, especially as industries evolve in response to technological change. And we also have data covering multiple industries over time. I think this data is also could be a great opportunity to study intertemporal economies of scope and also changes in structure over time. And also allow scholars to take more of a fine-grained approach to study the linkages between structure, corporate scope decisions, and performance. In addition to the data that the measures of org structure, I think the detailed data we have on executive teams would also allow scholars to take more of a micro-foundations approach, for example, to study dynamic capabilities, especially those below the CEO. And there are also lots of opportunities to combine this data with other sources such as LinkedIn to address questions related to mobility and inter-organizational knowledge transfer. So in summary, when we started to work on this data collection project, our goal was really to lower the barrier to study organizational structure and then thus spur future research in this domain. It took us over about 4 years to collect and develop this data set. And given the infrastructure and models that we have developed, we believe that this data set has a potential to be easily maintained and updated in the future. By making this data set publicly available, we respond to the call for large data sets in strategy, and we also hope to help scholars address a broader range of questions in areas such as corporate strategy, but also strategic human capital, behavior strategy, and strategic leadership. Through this work, we also hope to showcase the really exciting potential of generative AI for research and strategy. Okay, thank you very much, and I look forward to your feedback.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for presenting this very interesting new data set that you and your co-authors are assembling. And thank you so much also for being perfectly on time. Next, we've got Colleen, who is presenting a very important new project as well. So Colleen, over to you, please.
Thanks very much, Philip. Thanks, Lisa, for a great presentation. I couldn't help but be distracted a bit by thinking about how I could potentially use that excellent data set that you're creating, especially because you mentioned electric utilities, and that's the context for the paper that I'm talking about today. So thanks everyone for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night maybe to Lisa. So I know that she's very late. It's very early where I am. So thanks everyone. Today I'm going to be presenting a paper with Nell Dutt that started in essence when we were PhD students together. So it's been about a decade in working on this project and collecting the data for this project. It's been a struggle, but also a fun project to work on together. This project's now called Energizing Change: How Policies and Experience Drive R&D. We're focusing on renewable energy mandates in the U.S. electric utilities industry, and we're going to focus on the relationship between policies, these mandates, and electric utilities R&D spending. This is, I would say, at the periphery of corporate strategy papers. Let me see if I can make that work. Let me just summarize the paper for you in a slide. So overall, we know that policies are often used as an attempt to push and pull firms towards technological change, especially when that change is more socially desirable than maybe technologically or like competitively driven. And especially in industries where, you know, like electric utilities, where competition isn't typically focused on innovation. Such policies often have these direct targets that are quite narrow, but they also tend to have a broader goal. So for instance, a push towards green energy. So our first question in this paper then is to do such policies actually lead firms towards investing in technological change, in broader technological change? And then also we're trying to figure out, because we're strategy scholars, is there heterogeneity in firms' responses? So do we see firms with more related experience or less related experience being the ones who typically respond to policies by increasing their investment in technological change? As I said, our setting for this paper is the U.S. electricity industry from 2000 to 2010. Firms in this industry are typically not investing a lot in technological change, but that such change is often socially desirable. So these policies are important when we think about trying to push firms towards innovating. The regulation that we're thinking about, this policy we're thinking about, is renewable portfolio standards, which are state-level mandates that give us some variation across firms and across time. And in terms of investment in technological change, what we're thinking about is their R&D spending. We're able to look at total R&D spending and then break that out into internal R&D spending, so spending on internal projects, and external R&D spending, that is spending on projects with, say, universities, startups, et cetera. Spoiler alert, what we find is that these policies are associated with some increase in R&D spending, but only when the policies are really strong. So really like sort of big changes happening quickly in time. This is driven by firms' investment in external R&D, not internal R&D, which is perhaps not surprising given the context that we're looking at. And what we find is this is only for firms that have related experience, that have done some of their own investments in renewable electricity. So this is a question-driven approach that we're taking in this paper. So let me just outline the question before I get into the data and the results more specifically. So while technological change is often driven by the push of science and the pull of innovative competition, there are situations in which policies attempt to direct and encourage technological changes. For instance, we can think about changes related to underfunded or underdeveloped sort of diseases, but also things like attempts by the government to direct innovation towards things that are more socially desirable, green energy, green innovation. So our baseline question first is to try to think, like, do such policies actually increase such investments? Do renewable portfolio standards for electric utilities in the US actually lead to increased R&D investment by firms? And then, given this is a strategy audience and a strategy paper, we want to understand how how experience with the technology might moderate a firm's policy-related responses. You know, the tension here is that experienced firms might be the only ones that have sufficient resources and capabilities to benefit from increasing their R&D, but they're the ones that don't necessarily need to invest in response to the policy they're already doing something, versus those without any experience are really the ones often we think that are going to be targeted by these policies. They're the ones who have need, but potentially less ability to be able to increase their R&D. So we're asking this open question of, does experience help or hurt firms' policy-related responses in terms of their investments? Our context is the US electric utilities industry from 2000 to 2010. This is a time in which there was a lot of policy activity across states in the US in terms of trying to mandate or pull firms towards green energy using renewable portfolio standards. So what renewable portfolio standards are they're fairly similar in structure across the states that mandated them, which are the dark green states in this map here. Basically, it's like some percent of energy sold has to be renewable by some year in the future. So maybe it's 15% by 2020, or 25% by 2025, or 100% by 2035. There's a lot of variation in the specifics, but that's sort of the structure of these policies. And when I say stronger, I mean it's either bigger numbers or closer in time to when the policy is enacted, or some combination of both. And our measure actually combines both, although we pull them apart in some analyses. So the empirical setup in this paper, we have 130 publicly owned electric utility firms. These are the firms for which these policies are binding over these years when the policy is coming. These policies are being rolled out. Our outcomes are R&D. We have total R&D, and then we separated out internal R&D and external R&D, where external R&D is stuff spent with external partners. So you can get some sense of the raw numbers that they spend about $2 million on average per firm in R&D, although there's a ton of variation in how much is spent. And this is sort of less than 2% of less than 10% of revenue. So it's not a particularly R&D intensive industry to begin with. And what we're predicting, or what we're looking at, what relates to R&D spending is the policy strength, and then do they have renewable experience or not? We have a barrage of controls, state fixed effects, because the states are vary in terms of their characteristics, year fixed effects, state year controls, firm year controls. I won't go into those because I want to make sure that I keep on time like Lisa did. So in terms of our results, what do we find? So we're looking at trying to explain R&D as a function of the strength of these mandates, and separating it out based on renewable experience or experience related to the policy. What we find when we look at total R&D is, if we just look at the policy by itself, we don't see a relationship between policy and R&D spending. But when we separate out firms based on their experience relating to the policy, that is their experience in generating renewable electricity, it's the firms with some renewable experience that increase their R&D or increase. And it's stronger policies, or the policy strength really matters here in terms of the level that they increase. This is total R&D. When we break that out into external and internal R&D, it's driven fully by external R&D, increases in external R&D spending, which we don't find particularly surprising given this industry. Typically firms, even though they might have some technological experience, these aren't like big innovative firms. And so, they tend to finance or invest externally. So you get to put some more structure on these numbers. We can think like a one standard deviation increase in the strength of this policy and the enactment of this policy leads to an 8% increase in total R&D spending, or a 15% increase in external R&D spending by these firms. One thing that we think is important to break out, and we can do with the data that we have, is to unpack this external R&D into the different types of external R&D spending. So firms can spend on technological projects or less technological projects, more on like learning about development, et cetera. We wanted to investigate this because we thought, well, maybe it's just that these experienced firms are not really investing a lot in technology, but the results show that actually they're increasing both in technological projects and stuff that's more development focused. So it's both types of investments that are, and it's being driven again by these experienced firms. We then also, because the way that we look at the strength of the policy combines the two dimensions, that is like the strength of the size of the gap of the mandate and then also the time dimension. So it's like 25% and, you know, how many years until the policy is binding. We wanted to break those out so that we could get some sense of like, well, what's going on here? So when we look at that, we find that it, you know, it's really the size of the gap between what the firm's already doing and the policy mandate, that's positively driving what firms are doing. When we look at time into compliance, this is when we see firms that don't have ready renewable experience actually taking some action. So the only time we see them doing anything in terms of investment in R&D in response to the policy is policies that are off really far in the future. So that's what we see with this time into compliance dimension here. We also run a lot of different additional results, in part because, you know, what we've, our overall finding is that it's like experience matters for reaction to the policy. Then we're left with this quandary of like, well, what do inexperienced firms do? Do they just not react at all? So we ran a few additional analyses. Let me just draw your attention to two. One is, you know, we wanted to understand, is it really the policy that's leading to this investment increase? So we look at states. We look at variation in like firms' expectations that the policies will actually bind, given that these are future dated things, proxied by percent of Democrats. And we find the results are stronger in states with higher percent of Democrats, which suggests that policy sort of expectations of policy permanence matter. It doesn't seem that inexperienced firms are like lobbying more to change the policies and that's how they're reacting. So we don't really see any evidence of that. It just seems kind of that they're waiting to invest. So to conclude, in this paper, what we find is, you know, policy can incentivize investment in technological changes, but only for firms that have some related experience. Even then, and especially in industries where there's not a lot of experience and innovative activity, the movement is small. And there's implications for policymakers, I think, from understanding firm heterogeneity in responses to such policies. Thanks very much for your time and attention.
Thank you so much, Colleen. Very interesting paper. And now it's a real privilege to listen to Connie Helfert, who's going to provide comments for both Lisa's paper and Colleen's paper. So, Connie, over to you. Are you on mute?
Yes. Great. So it's great to see everybody today. The papers were fabulous. I really enjoyed reading them. I need to thank Philip for actually giving me papers to comment that are in topics where I've actually done some research, so I might have something intelligent to say. And I don't have slides, right? I have lots of notes here, and I'll be squinting at them. So word of warning, and I guess I have slightly under 12 minutes at this point. So let me see what I can do. So first of all, let me talk about the first paper with Albert, Eklund, and Tang. So Lisa, thanks for presenting it. Great summary of the paper. This looks to me like, I want to say a few words. It might fall into a category of what SMJ calls data set papers. So I'll talk a little bit of what that is. I want to talk about the data itself. It's a remarkable effort, enormous number of years. And companies, and then I want to talk about what one might be able to do with these data other than the sort of main purpose that you put to it in the paper and some of your thoughts. So that's where I'm going. Let me just read something to you for those of you who are not familiar with what a data set paper is. So this is an editorial that we wrote in SMJ in 2019. So I'll quote, "Articles on data sets, quote, discuss the data collection and organizing process for unique data sets, where the articles also contain important lessons for all researchers and the authors, all researchers and the authors make their data and documentation freely available immediately." So it's a way of, you know, getting data out there that would be hard to get in some other form that people can use. You know, the idea is not just to take a you know, something you've extracted from CompuStat and make it available. So you really need to do something that adds. So I would say that this paper does that in spades. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the data itself. So it turns out that I'm actually familiar with coding these data by hand, which I did in the early 2000s in a paper with Dawn Harris and Paul Wolfson in the Academy of Management Perspectives that appeared in 2006. And what we did is we coded all the functional areas and all the ranks in the hierarchy for a gazillion titles and functional areas for every executive that was listed in the 10Ks in 2000 for the Fortune 1000 companies. So I will never do this again by hand. you know, so kudos to you guys for using AI. So a few things to think about is that, you know, what you did, we only had 7 ranks in the data. And I'll tell you why in a minute, because at the bottom ranks, it gets very thin. So I think just as, you know, people use these data, you could choose what ranks you want to use and if you want to close some of them up. The other thing is in terms of the 6 roles, we also actually had many more roles. So we disaggregated a lot of the functional areas. So again, I think there's a potential for people to do that if you make some of the raw data available, because then they can use AI to do that. Because we were interested in gender, actually, in the roles of different genders and how they are distributed in the top team. So I think there's a lot of way to make this more granular by building on this data set. I think that, you know, a key issue is, first of all, the CXOs, I might have coded them a little more granularly, because a chief information officer and a chief financial officer, depending on the industry, might not be equally important in rank. But I think that the bigger issue is that, as you know, companies have a lot of latitude in how many executives they report. Some report 5, some report 20, right? So you're going to have some companies with a lot more information than others. And so I think that's something for people to understand, that you either have to control for that in your analyses or figure out, you know, do you want to condense the bottom because they're not comparable? Do you want to drop some of the bottom ranks? So so I think those are some issues in using the data. And then things in terms of thinking about what you might do with these phenomenal data. So you could do org structure. I have to say my gut reaction is that it's a rough proxy, very rough proxy for organizational structure, right? Because again, companies have so much latitude about who they put in the top team for what reason, right? And I think one reason they put people in the top team is because I think they have a need to know, not necessarily because of reporting structure, right? Those are might go together, but not necessarily. Like they need the information to get to the top in a way that it isn't in some other way. But it might not be that centralization or decentralization. So I would just, again, that's one reason why I think it's a rough guide to org structure, but I think it's pretty rough. So, I mean, I do think you could look at the evolution of the top team, which you guys mentioned, which I think is really interesting. You could look at it within companies, not just across companies, right? Which would, because you have so many years of data, you know, and then you can do things like if you code more granularly, you know, you go back to the issue of gender, which is a huge one. Now you've got data to actually look at this. I mean, you know, people could code genders, right? I mean, they'll be missing genders because some names are not clearly identified with a gender, but you could do some of this, right? Look, I mean, Mark's work, you could get much more fine grain on the response to active investors, you know, in terms of the distribution of what is in the top team, right? That might, you know, so you could build on some of that work. You could go back to some of the old topics and top management teams with a much more granular look, CEO succession, heir apparents. Oh my gosh, you have far better data now. So I think there's a whole ton of stuff that you could do with this. And I think using the generative AI, basically what the big benefit to me was taking all these titles, there are so thousands of them, and sort of, you know, getting them into 12 categories, which is really hard to do by hand. So great, Justin. All right, how am I doing for time? I think I'm okay. Okay, so Colleen and Nell, let me talk a little bit about your paper. First of all, I love the way you just pose. What's our overall question here, right? Can public policies lead to technological change, right? And you've got a great situation because electric utilities are not exactly known as innovators. Why? Because they're regulated. Why? They have no incentive to innovate, right? So it's a great setting. And, you know, it's not something where we have a lot of, like, general theories, right? Although we might have some general ones that it's likely to push them, right? But that's sort of unsatisfying. So, but let me just tell people, you know, this is again something that I'm proud to say SMJ sort of pioneered, these sort of question-driven approaches in strategy. And so there was a special issue in 2002, Melissa Graebner, Anne-Marie Knott, Marvin Lieberman, and Will Mitchell edited. And so for those who aren't familiar with sort of question-driven approaches, it's something that asks a new question. So I'm reading from the editorial, identifies an introductory article, identifies important puzzles regarding strategically relevant phenomena without developing or testing specific hypotheses, and offers meaningful results, which I would say this paper does 100%. So let me talk a little bit about some of the aspects here. First of all, I just say this external R&D is less studied. This isn't the same as open innovation. This is like, what are they investing in, right? Not just breadth of, you know, what they invest in. You know, and this is sort of due to the setting, but it's a great way to study it because most of these electric utilities don't have big R&D arms, right? So how do they get access to new technology? They hire someone else to do it, right? Okay. I think that it's a really important setting, renewable energy. I think you've got unique data, which I like to talk about. And then I think this policy shock to me is one way of thinking about the broader issue of adapting to exogenous change, right? And so I think you could even take a broader framing. What are we doing here? Then we have a specific question, right? And what you bring in nicely is the role of prior experience. So let me talk a little bit about the theoretical discussion in the paper and where I might recommend a little more depth. One is sort of, you know, you're looking at factors that would push companies to do more or less external R&D mainly. And so you say, well, companies that have more relevant experience, more likely to do this. I mean, which is something I've written about, other people have. I think you can flesh out what constitutes relevant experience, right? In general and in a setting like this, right? It's a little bit in the discussion of the data and results, but I think it's really important for the theory. Like, what do we mean, right? You know, I talk about complementary R&D. There are other things. And then you say, okay, on the flip side, you know, there might be these companies might have, you know, ones who have less relevant experience, you know, might actually do more of this because they're like in more trouble, right? Because they're not going to get that far. And then you say they might, you know, do more. Also, you say there's a benefit of waiting, you know, maybe less technological or knowledge lock-in. And one thing I wanted to say is that I think that the benefits of waiting depend on how fast the technology is changing, right? And also your point about the time period. How much time do you have, right? Can you wait, right? So I really think that's a broader issue. And you might want to weave that in. It's not just, oh, studies have found this. Well, it depends. Sometimes you don't want to wait because you'll get stopped out. Other times you need to wait because you don't know what the technology is and it's not moving that fast. So you can catch up, right? Okay, the other thing I just briefly mentioned is you didn't mention absorptive capacity to the very end of the paper. It might be something to put early. All right, I think let me just say a couple other words before I run out of time here. So in terms of the interpreting the effect sizes, I'd be a little careful with the interactions, interpreting effect sizes with interactions. Because it depends on the main effects. So you might want to take both of those into account when you look at the total effect size. So of your two main variables. And then I think with respect to the different types of external R&D, I think, you know, you've got great data here, right? I think you know, future work, you could do more. You've got at the project level. This is incredibly hard to get, right? You basically need confidential data of some type or regulated data, right? So you could actually think about which types are they doing, right? You know, just because you have experience in solar doesn't mean you're going to be really good at, you know, figuring out how to do, you know, hydro, right? So, I mean, I think there's a benefit of disaggregating here on the relevant experience. And I also think that the non-technological, what you call the non-technological R&D is actually quite interesting. It's more about implementation, right? It's not that it's not technological. And I think particularly for these companies, implementation matters. And that's why you do get results, just not as strong. So I think that might be worth a little more discussion. So at this point, I think I'll stop and we can turn it over to the next set of pages. And my colleague, Mark.
Thank you so much, Connie. Great points. And you're absolutely right, Mark is next. So Mark, over to you.
Okay, thank you.
And I think I mispronounced your name earlier, so I'm very sorry for that.
No, that's okay. You're in France and you get it. You get that French exception, right? And I've having lived in France, I've heard it all different ways. So it's okay, Philip. Thank you. I'm excited to present this paper. Thank you, Philip, for organizing this. Thank you, Emily, for providing feedback. This is a paper that's very much in progress. We're working through some feedback from reviewers. And so I'm really looking forward to the feedback because we're trying to figure out the mechanisms, trying to, you know, still some data work, taking a bit longer than anticipated, but I'm looking forward to getting feedback on this. I'm going to start the timer here just so I don't go over. So this is work with Wei Shi, Brian Conley, and Bo Shu Li, and we're looking at investor influence on managers' acquisition decisions. I want to begin with a quote from a investor relations officer of a Fortune 500 company I was talking with. And what he said about investors, we're talking about, you know, okay, how do you take investor information into account? This was the context of the conversation. And he told me they, speaking about investors, will be very open about what they think management should do on a variety of fronts, use of capital, bonus structures, approach to market or a competitor. And really what, you know, caught my attention for the interest of this paper is who to buy or what to sell, what they own or have an interest in, and sort of, you know, nothing being out of bounds for them. So there's a lot, you know, packed up in this quote. But I want you to keep those last couple of points in mind as we, you know, dive into this and thinking about where companies diversify and how managers might be led by their investors. So we know from the literature, I'll fly through this because I want to make sure I get through on time, that, you know, shareholders can have major impacts on companies, right? On their strategies, on corporate governance. Emily's done a lot of great work here, you know, especially on that, the divestitures. And so we you know, glean from that literature that, you know, institutional investors influence these decisions through these two major channels, voice and threat of exit. And both, what's important, what we're really trying to, the essence of this paper and why it genuinely excites me is we look at the literature, it's sort of a push strategy. And, you know, that, you know, it's this idea of sort of activism and, you know, engaging managers, telling them what to do. And what we're trying to establish in the paper is that maybe there's a pull strategy in which information still flows from investors to managers, but managers pull the information out rather than investors sort of force it on them. And so the idea is sort of this new form of influence. And like I'm saying, you know, pull versus push, that, and the question being, might managers look to investors for guidance in strategic decisions filled with uncertainty? So might they actually look to investors rather than say, you know, wait for investors to force them what to do? So we're going to test this in the context of diversifying acquisitions because, you know, it's not too hard of a case to make that these are managers face difficulty in understanding new industries. There's uncertainty about what to expect. And these are risky, right? Big decisions, high variation in performance. And we know that managers look for external information about industries to assist in their decision-making process in this, right? So they're looking for information about where to diversify next when they've decided to do that. So we're going to make the case that managers actually look to investors for guidance. Why? Institutional investors develop close relationships with managers. Managers interact with investors. So there's lots of, you know, like that IRO investor relations officer saying, you know, these were talking about private meetings with investors through investor roadshows, conferences, all these engagements that happen between managers and investors. And that, you know, managers' awareness of investors' portfolio holdings and their preferences is going to be informed by this conversation and data on investor portfolios. So before becoming a professor, I worked in investor relations at the world's largest fertilizer company. And my job, you know, very much looking at spreadsheets of institutional investors, who held our company, what else did they hold, where were they, really getting at this idea of trying to figure out where their interests were, you know, so we could feed that information to our, you know, CEO or board, CFO, who are meeting with these investors about, you know, informing those conversations and discussions. So it's clear that, you know, at least big companies, at least major, you know, there's a boundary condition here, major institutional investors, that managers will be aware of their holdings. And so we're going to say that, you know, managers might think about institutional investors as industry experts, or at least that they have preferences as in different industries. So these investors, they develop extensive research resources, right? They hire a lot of analysts. They're really, you know, a lot of them looking for industries, trends, where to invest, entire divisions focusing on this type of research, and, you know, this investor competence paper, some other papers saying that, like, investors can develop this special competence. Okay, so one example of this is First Manhattan, who you go to their website and directly says, like, our research analysts are industry specialists who evaluate current and prospective portfolio companies to assess the growth potential, you know, in those industries and the soundness of the business. So our main construct that we develop in the paper, just check my time here, is this idea of investor industry exposure. And this is the extent to which a firm's major, again, that boundary condition, institutional investors own shares of firms in another industry. So how exposed is the focal firm's investors to other industries? And so the argument is that when faced with uncertainty about where to diversify, managers are going to imitate their investors' portfolios. So, you know, like I said, managers can see this information as credible. This is actually, maybe there's like that First Manhattan quote, right? Like, there's potential growth in this industry space that they're not seeing. And then the other side of this is sort of a pacification argument that, like, imitating their major institutional investors is just going to get managers less pushback, right? That they're invested in these industries anyway. And so maybe there's sort of these two arguments going on. So we're going to say, when a firm makes an acquisition into a new industry, this diversifying acquisition, it is more likely on the margins to choose an industry in which its institutional investors have higher exposure to that industry via their portfolio holdings. There's two main assumptions in that, that investors possess credible information, which is important, and that managers lack information. So the two moderators, want to make sure I give, we're about halfway, get to the results really quickly, is that, you know, when the information is more credible, the managers are more likely to follow their investors. And we're going to say growth investors actually provide more credible information because, going back to that First Manhattan piece, that they're actually looking for high growth potential industries, doing a lot of research, rather than just a value investor, which is looking for an undervalued stock, right? Not looking at the potential, which obviously the former, the growth potential, you know, managers are going to care more about that with a diversifying acquisition. So basically, you know, that's a long way of saying H1 is going to be stronger for growth, for institutional investors that follow a growth strategy, right? So managers are going to be more likely to follow growth institutional investors into new industries rather than value investors. Okay. The other one is about the information availability. So when managers face less uncertainty, they're not going to look for that external information from their investors as much. So we're going to look at directors with work experience in a target industry, reducing managers' decision uncertainty. So again, a long way of saying is that that main effect is going to be weakened when the focal form firm actually has board members with experience in that target industry, right? That they're not going to be led by the investors. They're going to know anyway internally, just from internal information sources. Okay, and then we're going to look at market reactions as our fourth and final hypothesis, that, you know, sort of this investor industry exposure effect is going to, we're going to argue it's going to weaken sort of managers' due diligence process. They're going to follow investors more, and that we're going to see this, you know, managers becoming more confident, but more reliable just on investors rather than their own information. And we're going to look at the stock market reactions to what happens when investors follow their, managers follow their investors into these industries through diversifying acquisitions. Okay. So not to rush the back end here, but I want to end on time, is we're going to create, create this data set of 4,400 diversifying acquisitions in the US over about 18-year timeframe, transaction value greater than 1 million. So we're looking at major deals. We're going to create a match sample using CEM, basically to look at, create this set of pseudo deals, giving us, you know, the final sample you see there, 41,000 observations. And then H4 is through a deal level sample for those cumulative abnormal returns, which is what you see here. So our main dependent variable is whether the firm diversifies through acquisition into the industry or not. So we're going to have that, that 1-0 for the pseudo deals versus the diversifying acquisition deals, and then the cumulative abnormal returns. Okay. The investor industry exposure, this is too much to cover here, but it really is looking at each institutional investor, their holdings in the focal firm, and then their holdings in every other individual industry. And we're going to look at that and aggregate that for each institutional investor in the focal firm, right? Basically to get at the total exposure of all of its major investors in each individual industry. The moderators, we're doing that in investor industry exposure for growth and value investors. And then we're looking at director industry expertise, looking at the number of directors, it's a ratio with experience in that industry. Okay. So we're doing conditional logic regressions and then OLS for H4. Okay. Looking at, I gotta be careful here. So results. The main thing is looking at this, what we find is that firms are over 10% more likely to pursue a diversifying acquisition in an industry where their investors are invested when that investor industry exposure variable increases by 1%. That becomes 21% when those are growth institutional investors, and it decreases to just under 9% when they're value institutional investors. We find that main effect is weakened by about 3% when director industry experience increases from zero to its mean plus two standard deviations. So not a huge amount, but partial there. And then we find negative stock market reactions in these diversifying acquisition deals that are led by institutional investors. I want to get to the contributions, so I'm just going to go through, the pieces. We look at CEO tone and their reaction to these when they're following institutional investors. We look at whether they sell their stocks. Basically, what we find is that they're more confident in these deals. They're less likely to sell stocks, more likely to speak positively on M&A calls when they diversify into an industry in which their investors hold more stock. So what's the main takeaway here? We're trying to contribute. The main thing here is to shareholder influence literature, right? It's that push versus pull thing that I was talking about, that managers pull information from their investors and that guides them rather than more of the activism literature, which, that idea that investors are pushing managers into these spaces. We're looking at the effect of this idea of governance actors, industry expertise, and how actually industry experience not only lead to positive outcomes on the board, but actually, reduce negative outcomes. If we think about H4 and those abnormal stock returns to institutional investors and work on acquisitions, we're looking at the role of investor influence on this sort of idea of playing an information brokerage role, whether that's intended or not. What we're trying to tease out now really is, exactly what happens in that process of the black box where I opened with that quote about managers pulling information. Does that happen through meetings? Does that happen through, my experience of looking through spreadsheets and following investors? And then we're trying to contribute to this, work on strategic imitation very as like a very last attempt about investors being sort of imitation targets for firms. Okay. So I am out of time, so I'm going to skip the practical implications and pass it to the next person. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mark. Fascinating paper. And just a reminder to everybody, any questions, comments you have, feel free to post them in the chat. And of course, at the end, there may also be opportunity for you to raise them directly. Over to London, to Kathy.
All right, thank you so much for having me here today. Today I'm presenting work that's co-authored with Kyle Mayer from USC and Beverly Ridge from Utah on how do internal and external contracts differ, evidence from the semiconductor industry. And so the use of formal contracts between organizational units within firms raises a theoretical puzzle for strategy scholars. There's a fundamental distinction between firms and markets. So Williamson makes this distinction clear. He says, there's a logic of classical market contracting where firms use contracts to govern market transactions. And there's a logic of forbearance law where firms use authority to govern transactions within the firm. And the choice of one regime precludes the other. Now, this is in part driven by the notion of the business judgment rule, where internal formal contracts are non-enforceable in courts of law. As Williamson states, hierarchy is its own court of ultimate appeal. This is also driven by the idea that the incompleteness of contracts is what causes transactions to be internalized in the first place. So this is the reason for the existence of the firm. And so just to lay out a few definitions, what do we mean by formal contracts? We use the legal definition, which is written agreements between two or more parties that specify the rights, terms, conditions, compensation, and enforcement mechanisms for the exchange. Now, within firms, we're talking about wholly owned organizational units. These are 100% owned by the firm. Between firms or external, we're referring to fully or partially separately owned. So anything that's not 100% owned by the firm. Now, while all agreements may contain some of these elements within them, what's important is that the relative weights of what they contain may differ, especially if we think of formal contracts as being used to address transactional problems. The transactional problems within firms may differ from transactional problems between firms. Now, this is theoretically and empirically important. Over 60% of world trade is generated by transactions within firms. 69 of the top 100 economies of the world are firms. Fortune 500 firms accounted for over 2/3 of US GDP in 2019. Every day, billions of transactions happen within firms. And, you know, as a field, we actually know very little about what these internal contracts contain. What do they look like? So the purpose of this study is to ask the simple question, what are the primary issues addressed in internal contracts and how do they differ from contracts between firms? So we're going to take as given the internal contracts. So we're not looking at whether or not they have it, but given that they have one, what is contained in these contracts? We aim to make an empirical contribution where we're going to do topic modeling on the formal contracts. We want the data to speak for itself rather than us imposing our own theory on the data. We're going to develop some stylized facts and then do some regression analyses to better understand how internal and external contracts differ. And in so doing, we also will contribute to the theory of the governance of transactions and the governance of the firm, the theory of the firm. Now, from existing research, we do have some baseline expectations. So existing research would maybe suggest that based on the business judgment rule, one might expect that internal contracts will actually place very little to no emphasis on enforcement terms. Also, because incentives are weaker within firms than between firms, it may mean that internal contracts will place greater emphasis on compensation than external contracts. From research that theorizes, internal contracting theories has basically, you know, discussed how internal transactions face incentive and coordination problems stemming from common ownership of assets. So because there's common ownership within the firm, it becomes ambiguous over who has rights to manage the asset, who has rights to modify it, make strategic decisions over it, and use it in different cases. So whereas in markets, the laws around property rights are pretty well developed for transactions between firms, in firms, there's actually fewer legally defined property rights. And so this ambiguity can create issues over negative externalities and potentially liabilities within the firm and issues over whether or not the assets and resources are used effectively and put to their best use. So one might expect that internal contracts may place greater emphasis on property rights than external contracts based on this literature. So data, we've collected proprietary data on internal and external material formal contracts from 8 firms in the semiconductor industry. The average annual revenue of these firms was $1.2 billion over a sample period. Because these firms only had 54 external contracts, we ended up supplementing this with external contracts from their competitors based on what was listed as their competitors in Capital IQ. So we searched SEC filings, Law Insider database, and through a Google search. This is because we're doing a topic modeling analysis and the results tend to be more stable if you have over 100 documents when you analyze it. So we matched these firms to make sure that they weren't significantly different in terms of their total revenue, total assets, or R&D intensity. And we also screened to make sure that the contract types were similar to those that we see within the firm. All right. So then we employed, HDP topic modeling. This is unsupervised topic modeling, where we leverage the data's richness to identify the contract's central issues rather than trying to impose our own theory on the data. And the key thing about HDP is that it actually identifies the optimal number of topics per corpus of text analyzed. So we don't actually specify how many topics we want it to come up with. Our approach was to first do topic modeling on external contracts and then try to reconcile the results with existing theory on external contracting to validate our methodology. Then we apply the same algorithm to internal contracts. And then we also pool the two and do topic modeling again with the same algorithm to assess the relative weights of the contribution to the topics for internal and external contracts. And then finally, we use the output of the topic modeling for regression analyses where we can control for other factors. Now, this table shows the number of contracts in our sample. So we have 168 internal contracts, 365 external. We have amendments in this, so we're able to create a panel data set and look at changes over time. What's interesting is that external contracts have almost twice as many words per contract than internal. If we actually look at the text of the contracts, here is an example. Representative sample. These are both from the same firm, but one contract is external, one contract is internal. And what we see is a difference in specificity. So in this one, they say that the services and developed deliverables is described in development schedule based upon Exhibit A specifications, which development schedule and or specification may be modified from time to time in accordance with the procedures described in the modification of specification. In the internal, we see a lot more flexibility and ambiguity built in, where they say that the contractor will, in consultation, determine the number of developed products and improvements it shall devote to its design, development, and support efforts. At Party A's option, it may, from time to time, with the agreement of the contractor, define specifications, performance milestones, or schedules. So what we see is that within the firm, they have alternative means to coordinate the transaction, whereas between firms, they're having to actually write it into the contract. And if you look at these schedules of Exhibit A, Exhibit B within the contracts, they're doing things to like the millimeter of design. So they're being quite specific as what they require. This table shows the contract types, and consistent with internalization theories, what we see is that there's a greater proportion of internal contracts associated with R&D, sales, marketing, distribution, and services. External contracts have a greater proportion associated with manufacturing and licensing. This table contains the topic modeling results to the HDP analysis for external contracts. And what we see is that liabilities, which is the first one in enforcement, come through as topics. This is consistent with research on contracts being used to safeguard the exchange and align incentives for the parties to perform as agreed upon. And then we see contingencies, roles and responsibilities, which are associated with coordination and adaptation for the exchange. IP rights is consistent with research that shows how these contracts are used to allocate control rights when you have parties working in collaboration or R&D, or to enforce the IP rights of the parties in the exchange. And then finally, we have specifications, which is about providing clarification and definitions for the exchange. Internal contracts, we applied that same analysis to the internal contracts. And what was surprising to us was that enforcement popped out as number one. We also see, consistent with the property rights perspective, control rights are a topic here, as well as liabilities, roles, responsibilities, and IP rights. What's interesting is that we also come out with a compliance, where they're using these contracts to build in compliance for the different organizational units. And we also have contingencies in here. Now, one thing to note is that this topic modeling for the internal contracts came up with control rights and compliance, which were not present in the external contracting topic modeling results. The external topic modeling results had specifications, which were not here. So basically what it's showing is that internal contracts, if we only focus on external contracts, we may miss important elements of the role of contracts in governing exchanges. Here's the pooled analysis, and the topics are generally the same as what we had seen before, except the control rights and compliance fall out of the topics once we pool internal with external together. Specifications is within this, and then a new category of compensation emerges when we pool it. This chart shows the relative weight of the contribution for internal versus external contracts. And what we see is that internal contracts focus relatively more than external on IP rights, enforcement, which was surprising to us, roles and responsibilities, and liabilities. External contracts, in contrast, focus more on specification, contingencies, and then compensation looks like it's approximately similar. Now, when we enter the document topic probabilities, its dependent variables and regression analyses, what we find is that internal contracts are associated with a 12.3% greater focus on IP rights, 13.4% greater focus on enforcement. Roles and responsibility is non-significant, so it's showing that they're both important in both. Specifications, it has 11.5% less. It's also less emphasis on contingencies for internal contracts relative to external, but greater emphasis on liabilities. And again, surprisingly, internal contracts place less emphasis on compensation, which we might have expected them to place more. Now, looking at a full model, we also do a within firm analysis by using firm fixed effects. And what we find is roughly similar results, except for roles and responsibilities, once we include those firm fixed effects on the sample of firms that have both internal and external contracts, we see that they become significant and specifications become marginally significant once we take that into account. We do a variety of robustness checks and additional analyses. We do subsample analyses. We look at an alternative industry. We do a two-stage instrumental variable analysis to account for the endogenous decision to internalize. And we also consider the alternative explanation where this may be associated with transfer pricing. We control for cross-border transaction, and we also do the within firm with roughly consistent results. Going back to enforcement, we see enforcement is very salient here. Looking at the contracts, we see internal and external both mention court of law, but there's a lot of variation in these internal contracts where you may go to management, mediation, court of law. Some refer to arbitration. You may say, do they actually sue their parents? Well, we see anecdotal examples in the news. There's court cases. We talked to general counsels of companies, and you know what some of them said is, yeah, they can sue. We use arbitration clauses in our contracts to keep it private. When we talk to managers, does this even matter to you? And they say, of course it matters. If we didn't have enforcement, we wouldn't care. But because of it, everybody's very careful to make sure that they do what they said that you would do. So basically, this is credibly shifting the payoffs of the parties of the exchange, where parties are more likely to adhere to the agreement. This reduces the likelihood of ex post reneging, and it's more clearly a violation of the relational contract. So we look at these as complementary to relational contracts within firm, and then by shifting the payoffs, it's basically bolstering those. So what does this mean? The choice of hierarchy does not necessarily preclude the choice of contract law. It's about hierarchy and contract law. So this is the first evidence of the differences between internal and external formal contracts. We contribute to the literature of formal contracts as governance mechanisms, saying that, you know, these formal contracts, we're seeing they're adapted to complement the transactional context, firms versus markets. For internal, they're featuring more rights allocations than external. They have control rights and IP rights within them. External are focused more on specification and contingencies because that separate ownership determines authority. They have to specify exactly what they want for the exchange to set expectations for the agreement. And then these internal contracts are placing significant emphasis on enforcement. So it means the choice of hierarchy does not preclude the choice of contract law. This is shifting that payoff structure to reinforce the relational contracts internally. And it raises many research questions for future research on the theory of the firm, dispute resolution processes within firms, transactional governance, divestitures, org design, and resource management. So with that, thank you.
Thank you so much, Kathy. Very, very interesting research. And now we have the privilege of listening to Emily, who is going to provide comments on both Mark's paper as well as Kathy's paper.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Philip. Thanks, Louise. And thanks, everyone, for being here, as well as our presenters, for some really interesting presentations. What a pleasure to sit here for an hour and a half and talk about research. I never get to do this anymore, so made me happy here this morning. So I have a couple of slides here, mainly to keep my scattered brain in order, and I'm happy to share these after the fact. But please take everything with a grain of salt. These are just my musings on the two papers. So let me start with Mark. It's a great paper, you know, super interesting. I think that it is incredibly important, having done research on this myself, to understand how owners and investors are affecting strategic choices. Obviously, there is a burgeoning stream of literature on this. You know, if you look back at the olden days, right, you can see sort of the research on blockholders from the early 90s, but we've obviously really expanded this viewpoint of kind of different types of investors, right? Looking at private equity, shareholder activists, right? Dedicated versus transient investors, the work on ownership competence that you cited. So I think that this is just a really rich and fruitful area for research right now. And I only expect it to increase actually in the coming years, just from what I observe in my view of the field. I want to add a point here that I don't have in my slides, but you said it during your talk, Mark, and I thought it was a great point. So you mentioned kind of the pull versus push. And I thought that was a really, really interesting way of framing it, in the sense that you're right, you know, we kind of do have a lot of push here, especially if you see kind of these activists, right, and the private equity sort of saying, like, this is what we think you should do, right, in terms of your strategy. So I kind of love the idea of saying, well, what's the pull, right? What can we get in terms of taking that information, kind of screaming out for a theory paper here, maybe on some of those distinctions. So I just wanted to flag that there as I talk about, you know, sort of this bigger view of this field of ownership and strategy. The other point that I want to reflect on here is that expertise and knowledge obviously play a huge role, maybe in line with kind of push versus pull. But really recognizing that, you know, firms and managers get information from a lot of different sources, right? So board members, right? We have a ton of research on, you know, kind of inputs that board members can provide. External advisors, right? Consulting firms, investment bank, lawyers, right? And you can argue about sort of the value of different sources of input from these actors, perhaps, depending on how cynical you are. But I think that it's important to recognize that that's a source of information as well. And as your work more broadly, but especially in this paper, has shown, maybe investors actually have expertise and knowledge that they can share. You know, also highlighting the fact that there's different flavors of expertise and knowledge. The industry, as you were talking about, but also firm-specific experience, transaction-specific experience, human capital, in terms of their position potentially within the company, right, and so on and so forth. And the point that I want to make here as well, just to kind of wrap this part up, is to say, well, look, we know actually, and I've done work on this, Connie has as well, that sometimes expertise and ownership can reinforce one another, right, in the sense of thinking about kind of owners with skin in the game, right? So why do activist hedge funds, or what is one of the reasons why activist hedge funds add so much value, is that they actually have a lot of expertise and they have skin in the game, right? So there's that reinforcement effect. There's also situations in which maybe owners don't have the right expertise, or people who have the right expertise don't have ownership, right? And so you can imagine potentially offsetting effects, right? So all this to say, I think this is a super important area of work, both in terms of ownership in and of itself, but also in terms of kind of that relationship between expertise and ownership. In terms of, you know, sort of thoughts and maybe suggestions to think about as you take this work forward, you know, so obviously there is a key issue of timing here, right? In terms of when the decision to do a diversifying acquisition occurs, kind of before, whether that decision occurs before or after managers are kind of gleaning that industry specific information from investors. So you can imagine two paths here. One is that managers decide to diversify and then get encouraged when their investors are in that space. Or alternately, investors can be in that space and that prompts managers to make that decision in the first place, right? So obviously you're advocating for more of the latter than the former, but this is something that I wondered throughout, you know, is it possible that we sort of see kind of this alternate mechanism where it's kind of pull, but it's maybe a bit softer than sort of we're actually choosing on the basis of the fact that investors are in this area. Relating to this issue, right, I wondered a bit about information cascades, right? So I think that uncertainty is clear, right, with any diversification decision, with any corporate decision, uncertainty is high, but the sequentiality, I think, is where I got a little bit stuck on this point. And, you know, maybe kind of to twist this and say it a bit differently, you know, as kind of a final point here, you know, is it that investor industry exposure is solving a problem that managers don't have the right information? Or is it revealing an opportunity that maybe they didn't think about, right? So again, kind of the same issue, but just putting it a little bit differently. I wondered a bit about the diversification decision, right? So I don't know that I totally buy that we see investors in an area and therefore we make a decision to diversify. You can imagine synergies, complementarity, risk reduction, all of the standard explanations for why you might make a diversifying acquisition. So Amazon buys Whole Foods, right? That's a diversifying acquisition. Is it their strategy that they wanted to have lockers in grocery stores where people could pick up their packages, or is it industry exposure, right? So I wondered a bit about this, and it relates, of course, to the previous point that I just made. On the topic of diversification, I wondered a bit about pharma French industries, right? So, you know, is this a good way to measure diversification, right? In my Amazon Whole Foods example, I would actually argue that it's not diversification, right? It was a very natural part of the strategy that this company was pursuing, but you would classify it as diversifying. Relatedly, you know, should we distinguish between sort of related diversification versus unrelated diversification? And of course, that opens a whole hornet's nest of issues, but something to ponder as well. Finally, and not to get too far into the weeds, you know, I wondered a little bit about sort of the two-stage model and the instrument especially. So is it the acquisition itself that is destroying value, or, you know, is it the exposure of the investors that's the problem in the first place, or maybe they're in the wrong place, right? So on the industry, right, local diversifying acquisitions might be correlated with kind of merger waves, and so CAR might be correlated with that. So I wasn't totally convinced maybe on some of the methods there in terms of the value of these transactions, right, for the fourth hypothesis. But all in all, a great paper, super interesting, and really enjoyed kind of reflecting on a lot of topics and ideas that are near and dear to my heart. So thank you for this. Let me turn now to Kathy's paper, and I really enjoyed this paper as well. I felt like I was learning something that is a bit outside of my wheelhouse, and I spent a good bit of time, you know, trying to connect it to what I do think about and some of the issues that are important to me. So I think it's incredibly important to understand the internal functioning of multi-business firms, right? So obviously this is a TCE study, and, you know, with the authors, of course, it's clearly positioned in that domain. But I think there's a much broader, you know, sort of field here that this could connect to, right? Especially in terms of, you know, sort of governing these companies that have businesses in a lot of different areas, as well as kind of the transactions they might take to change their scope. So it's kind of assumed away in the paper, but maybe it shouldn't be, right? So sort of thinking about where do we shift firm boundaries and what does that imply for sort of the companies that we're looking at and their internal functioning, even the work on parenting that I think is relevant here, and how multi-unit firms might add or destroy value for their business units. So I guess I would say that there's kind of a bigger picture here that's important to kind of connect to even beyond kind of the TCE side. The other issue that really struck me was how important it is to bring in kind of the law, right? So I've gotten a real education in this myself just from kind of my outward facing work recently, but it's incredibly important to understand how these legal aspects affect corporate decision making. And if you're reading the newspaper, you see this every day, right? So contracts obviously at issue in this paper, antitrust, national security, non-compete agreements, right? All of these issues are just making headlines and really radically changing kind of corporate decision-making and corporate policies. So I strongly advocate for more research that kind of looks on the legal aspects. Finally, of course, you know, super cool data, and it's incredibly rare to be able to look at this level of granularity within the company. So kudos to you guys for kind of putting in the effort and doing this work here on the data side of the story. In terms of thoughts, and I have one more that I'll add here that I was kind of pondering while you were talking. So, you know, obviously you frame this very much as kind of a theoretical puzzle, right? That there is a choice between markets and hierarchy or contracts and hierarchy, and that the two are fundamentally incompatible, right? It's kind of the way that this is framed. So I wondered, you know, does this really match the reality of business practice, right? Is it really surprising, I guess, in a sense, that companies use contracts to govern how their business units interact with one another? So, you know, I kind of felt myself torn here a bit because on the one hand, you know, obviously there's a theoretical implication here that's, you know, from Williamson. So we have to take it seriously, and that's important. But I also wonder if it kind of minimizes the practical contribution to frame it in that way, but vice versa, maybe there's kind of a trade-off there. So, you know, just the thought, right, in terms of thinking about what you want to emphasize and how you might want to reflect on sort of theory versus practice here as you think about this this gap, right, of kind of contracts versus hierarchy. So one thing that I wished for kind of throughout the paper was, you know, what are these contracts actually governing, right? So you have kind of your broad categories, and the graphs that you showed I thought were actually incredibly helpful in the talk here today. But, you know, I was kind of longing for, you know, what are the interactions? What are these companies doing? What are the business units doing vis-a-vis one another? I wasn't 100% clear as I was reading the paper, so maybe just a bit more color would have been useful. I was unsure about the idea of choice, right? So, of course, you know, the paper has all the bells and whistles, right, and sort of saying we need to take care of endogeneity, and that's super important, and you know, we all do it, of course, but I wonder, you know, is there really a choice here? So the robustness test makes it seem that in a given circumstance, right, there's a choice to govern either by internal or external transaction, but I'm not sure that really matches the reality of this issue. And the reason that this kind of stuck out to me is that the sampling process sort of said, we're starting with these internal contracts, and then we're adding sort of these external contracts that were done by other companies. So how can we say that there's a choice between internal and external, given that we're not actually looking at, you know, the same sort of options across both sets of both sets of contracts, right? So that was something I wondered about. The other thing I'll mention here, this is the point that I kind of jotted down for myself while you were talking. So I wonder if there's kind of a third way also here, in the sense of saying that sometimes there are contracts that can be hybrids of both internal and external. And having worked on spinoffs, as most of you probably know, in a lot of my work, right, I've seen these in action, right? So a transition services agreement, right, is explicitly a contract that's designed to manage the transition from hierarchy to market. So, you know, do we actually consider that as an internal contract? Do we consider it as an external contract? Does it have implications? So I understand that, you know, you ruled out the transactions and you didn't look at these in particular, but I wondered if it was too black and white here to sort of say, like, well, we're not paying attention. There are no hybrid contracts. And, you know, TSAs are only one example of these, right? So you can imagine many contracts governing spinoff processes, right, or other types of divestitures and so on and so forth. So I'm happy to talk more about that, but it just kind of stuck out to me. The final thing I want to say, and I know I'm a minute over here, sorry, Philip, is that while topic modeling is far from my area of expertise, I was wondering if there's some way to kind of play with firm-specific characteristics and firm-specific outcomes to kind of look at boundary conditions and outcomes here. So on the boundary conditions, one that was sticking out to me is, you know, what happens in these internal contracts when you have firms that are more widely diversified or where business units are more unrelated to one another? So is there anything that you could do to kind of explore maybe boundary conditions from that perspective? You know, equally on the outcome side of the story, are there kind of performance measures that you could look at here in terms of understanding the implications of the decisions that companies make and what they actually include in their internal versus external contracts? So thanks for letting me run over for a second. Again, and thank you so much to the presenters for a really interesting set of papers. I'll turn it back over to Philip and Louise here.
Thank you so much, Emily. Excellent points, and I'm sure both Mark and Kathy are going to be grateful for those. So since we've got 3 minutes, if you've got any questions you want to raise in person rather than the chat, now is the time to do that. Feel free to switch on your camera and raise the questions to the authors. Of course, alternatively, feel also free to directly email them any comments or questions that you've got. All right, I don't think anybody's speaking up. So with this in mind, what I'd like to do as a very last thing, especially targeting the PhD students and the postdocs out there, just to advertise an event or two events rather that we're very soon are organizing. So it's scheduled for the 23rd of May and the 28th of May. Two PhD network shops, again, targeted at PhD students as well as postdocs. It's really a great opportunity to get feedback on your research in a very small group environment. And given the time zone challenges, we've got one organized for Europe and Asia-based students or postdocs and one for kind of the Americas as well. And we've got great senior scholars who've committed their time to give you feedback. But of course, also to kind of just network with you. So it's a great opportunity. Feel free to take a screenshot of that and follow that rather complicated looking link. Of course, if you won't be able to kind of type this down in time, feel free also to email Florence or myself directly. Technically, application deadline was yesterday, but you know we're not that rigid on the application deadline. So feel free to email us. And so with that, what I'd like to do is I'd very much like to thank the presenters today. So Lisa, Colin, Mark, and Catherine for your fantastic papers and sharing your latest research with us. And of course, special thanks also to Connie and to Emily for your excellent points that really are going to be helpful for the authors as they're kind of proceeding, of course, with hopefully publishing all of these four excellent studies. Thank you very much, everybody, and looking forward to seeing you in person at the upcoming conferences.